The best way I can liken it is to a funeral, but a funeral where you didn't know the person had died in the first place. Thank you for coming. Grandpa has just died.
Should we be writing obits for the Washington Post? New owner, Amazon billionaire Jeff Bezos, doesn't think so. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. In fact, according to Bezos' own biographer, the paper may have just been saved from extinction.
The Washington Post has just been empowered by a guy who has unimaginable wealth, doesn't care about losing money, and is going to get serious about building something significant on the internet.
Also, difficult men and why we love them on cable TV dramas.
We're both attracted to the idea of assuming that kind of male power, and we're repelled by it. It's an extraordinarily powerful, seductive thing to watch.
All that and so much more after this.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is a free service of WNYC Radio. Go to onthemedia.org to find out where On the Media is playing in your area and to support your local public radio station. You can support this podcast by making a donation at wnyc.org.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
For the 10 minutes it takes us to speak, no videos, no tweets, no posts, because I'm telling you something.
Washington Post Company CEO Don Graham gathered his staff together on Monday and delivered a bombshell.
We have sold the Washington Post newspaper to Jeff Bezos, founder of Amazon. For those who care, the price is $250 million.
The shock for those in the room and everywhere else was twofold. First, after 80 years, the Washington Post has become synonymous with the Grahams, whose dedication to journalism at the expense of maximum profitability was the antithesis of modern corporate newspapering. The second jaw-dropper was that the new owner is best known for inventing shiny new businesses, not salvaging rusty old ones.
He is famous for patiently investing for years to solve problems, and he's famous for succeeding in most of those investments. His ownership means, I think, literally the best chance for long-term success for the Post.
When Graham stood before his assembled staff at 15th and L Streets, his announcement blindsided a room of professional information gatherers paid never to be blindsided. Apart from the top management, only Washington Post media reporter Paul Fahrey was unsurprised, because after being alerted to the news by editor Martin Barron on Sunday, he had reported the story that was published simultaneously with the staff meeting at 4:33 p.m.
The best way I can liken it is to a funeral, but a funeral where you didn't know the person had died in the first place. Thank you for coming. Grandpa has just died. This, you know, went over like an anvil had just dropped.
To Fahrey, even the venue for that meeting added to the poignancy of the moment.
We're standing in the community room on the first floor of the Washington Post, and back in the day being about 1998, that was where our enormous presses would turn every night, and now this was the site of the announcement about how we're going to forge ahead into the new media world of the 21st century.
Let's talk about that, because this is not like RCA selling to General Electric, a big deal between sort of faceless corporations. There's a lot of emotion here, a lot of history, and a lot of a shared family sacrifice.
That's right. I the Grahams have been good to us as employees, one, but I think the Grahams have been good for America. That sounds grandiose, but I do believe that you can make a very strong case that they have contributed to American society by their contribution to journalism. They've backed us as reporters. They've backed us in legal trouble. They've put people into places where they could and some did get killed. They've been crusaders for essentially the truth.
I was trying to think of an analogy for how the news would land. King Edward abdicating the throne of England or something like that. The best I could come up with was it was like mommy and daddy putting you up for adoption, only your parents are doing this unthinkable thing to save you from the Nazis. In this case, the Nazis being the newspaper economy that has caused the Post to just hemorrhage red ink for years.
no one's dying around here, but that is effectively the kind of choice that we were facing. It's bewildering to have to leave, you know, our parents' arms into this new thing. But the question is, what were the choices? The choices are all bad, and this may be the least bad choice we have.
Of all of the people or institutions that could have purchased the Washington Post from the Grahams, what was the reaction to it being this guy?
If Don Graham thinks Jeff Bezos is the guy to take over essentially his child and to raise his child in a good home, then it must be true. He does not have a history of doing things because it will make him a lot of money. But we're also reporters. When we all want to know more, we've looked into him, and there are things that you could say, well, maybe that's not the best background for a newspaper owner. But again, I keep putting my faith in Don. He hasn't steered us wrong before, and, you know, God willing, he hasn't done it now.
Paul, thank you.
Thanks very much for having me, Bob.
Paul Fahre covers media for The Washington Post. In a letter to his new staff, Jeff Bezos wrote, quote, "There is no map, and charting a path ahead will not be easy." Yeah, Jeff, they know. The very digital revolution that made you a multi-billionaire has been their ongoing revenue-erasing nightmare. The moment they left the room, they no doubt began researching you to see if you are likely to fulfill the faith the Grahams have in you and to hope your business acumen and digital vision can provide a rescue. In October, a book titled The Everything Store, Jeff Bezos and the Age of Amazon, will help fill in a lot of the blanks. Author Brad Stone believes that Post employees and others with a stake in profitable newspapering have some reason for optimism.
The first is he really does see opportunities for reinvention everywhere. He thinks that the internet is basically a big reset button for the relationship between companies and their customers, and you see that within Amazon. And I think the Post is another expression of that optimism. The second thing I'd say is that he has always loved content. He's an avid book reader. He says he reads several newspapers a day. His wife's a novelist. And so he does have a passion for the printed word.
One thing about Amazon.com, it has gone against the grain of almost every other publicly held company in the world in being given permission by the markets to play the long game, to not have to deliver increased earnings every single quarter. He seems to be almost unique in his ability to be trusted by Wall Street to just take his time.
It's true. But I would point out that he sort of has earned that credibility. There were, you know, a tremendous number of skeptics about Amazon between the years 2000 and around 2007, 2008. And then in about 2009, 2010, they started showing big profits. And since then, they've just been pretty good in broadcasting when they're going to lose money, when they're in what they call a growth phase or an investment cycle. And so, you know, the shareholders that he has just really believe in him and believe in his vision and the long-term stuff he talks about. And they're in it for the long run. They think he's creating the next Walmart.
Newspaper economics being what they are, a short-term play is almost certainly going to be an abject failure. Do you think he has a plan or just the patience to know that if anyone can pull this job off, it's him?
He says that he doesn't have a plan. I think he probably has more of an idea that he's letting on, but he has predicted that, you know, there won't be print newspapers in 20 years, and frankly, who thinks there will be? And it's sort of funny, the chief digital officer of the Washington Post is a former Amazon guy and actually created the Prime shipping service at Amazon. So he'll let those folks experiment and grow their business, and they'll allow them to go and kill the traditional Washington Post business. And that isn't a luxury that the public company has had. Jeff Bezos really looks up to Warren Buffett. And Buffett's been buying newspapers lately and arguing that the local newspaper has this unique relationship in a community and that nothing can replace it. You know, I think Bezos is taking that advice and is going to go and give the digital guys at the Washington Post a lot of leeway to lose more money in the short term, all for the reason of kind of building a new outpost on the digital frontier. I mean, look, I mean, Washington is it's a one-industry town, and there are plenty of, you know, lobbying organizations and other entities that want to reach the Post audience, and Politico has showed that, right? And actually, I think if you're Politico right now, you're probably a little fearful because the Washington Post has just been empowered by a guy who has unimaginable wealth, doesn't care about losing money, and is going to get serious about building something significant on the internet.
Sole proprietors get into the newspaper business for a lot of reasons, including political influence. Jeff Bezos hasn't had a whole lot of political hobby horses that we know of. Do you think there's anything lurking out there that he will use the Washington Post to take on?
It's unclear to me whether in the back of his mind he was viewing ownership of the Post as a way to increase the volume of his voice in Washington. But what's certain is that Amazon is going to have many critical issues before regulators and legislators. I mean, the company is increasingly monolithic in books and in the sale of electronics. And if Barnes & Noble or Best Buy go under, we're all going to be talking about its market power. So owning any newspaper gives you a form of soft power and influence, even if you don't use it. But, you know, Jeff Bezos is apolitical. There's not much of a record there. He contributed to a same-sex marriage ballot initiative in Washington that won. He's contributed to a few Democratic candidates, but is sort of generally thought of as a libertarian. I don't assume that he'll have political influence on the Post editorial board.
He will already have a vast influence on American life and the lives of people all over the world as the man pulling the strings at the everything store. Are there structural conflicts of interest that are going to inevitably arise as his retail visions evolve?
Amazon already has issues before states and the United States government. You know, sales tax is the biggest one. And Bezos's kind of argument, at least at first, was that, you know, you needed a federal solution and they shouldn't pay taxes in states where they didn't have physical operations. And of course, they did have physical operations there. You know, they sneak through the same tax loopholes as Google and Apple. So he'll have to be careful, and I'm sure they know it, when it comes to advocating for those issues and, you know, where the Post editorial board and its reporters come down on those issues.
He's a prickly guy, is he not? Do you think he can engender the kind of fealty, even love, that the Washington Post journalists have for the Grahams?
I think by and large, Jeff Bezos has tremendous loyalty. Not total, but it was surprising to me how many people, even who spent considerable time at Amazon, felt incredible affection for him because, you know, he's straightforward. He means what he says. You know, he's not easy to work for. He's sort of Steve Jobs-like with his temper and with his demands. But people generally feel like he pushes them and gives them the resources to do impressive things. And so I have a feeling that the journalists at the Post, who, like the rest of us in the media, have kind of been, you know, stirring in this pot of pessimism for so long, you know, we're going to see Bezos as a little bit of a relief.
Brad, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob.
Brad Stone is a senior writer for Bloomberg Businessweek. The book title, once again, The Everything Store, Jeff Bezos and the Age of Amazon, in bookstores in October.
Coming up, we peer into the nation's earliest decisions about media technology and the awesome chaos they've wrought.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com. Working to protect individuals and businesses by ensuring accurate internet search results and authentic online reviews. More at reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION. On the Media is supported by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform designed to provide a simple way to create a website or online portfolio. Squarespace provides templates and drag-and-drop tools so users can create their own professional websites. Every website includes a mobile design that automatically scales to any device, hosting, and e-commerce. And for users who would like extra help, Squarespace provides 24/7 support. For a free trial, visit squarespace.com/media.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. It's no big news that new technology is menacing traditional media, but it's not for the first time. In the 60s, computer-generated cold type began doing to thousands of linotype operators what Gutenberg's press had done to scribes. Nowhere did the revolution pay out more dramatically than in New York City, where in December 1962, the threat of cold type led a consortium of labor unions to strike. New York's 7 daily newspapers were closed for 114 days to devastating effect. Scott Sherman wrote about the strike in a web exclusive for Vanity Fair titled The Long Goodbye. He describes pre-1962 New York as a thriving newspaper town in which multiple editions of seven newspapers rolled off the presses throughout the day. Of the seven, the three papers that survived the strike were The Times, The Daily News, and The New York Post, which, as Sherman pointed out when we spoke to him last December, was then in a pre-Murdoch incarnation.
The Post was a liberal crusading paper. It went after Joe McCarthy. It went after Richard Nixon. So I think that was the paper that crossed class boundaries more than the others did. Upper class educated people read the New York Times and the New York Herald Tribune. There were two mass market morning tabloids with powerful working class readerships, the Daily News and the New York Daily Mirror. And then you had two afternoon broadsheets, the Hearthstone New York Journal American and the World Telegram and Sun.
The linotype machine was this enormous apparatus that had a keyboard, and it would lay individual letters mechanically, and then they would be molded with hot lead into the type that created the impression on the newspaper. How many people did it take to operate?
It took one skilled man to operate it, but it took a number of other people to maintain it. In the 1950s, newspaper publishers, especially at non-union papers like the Los Angeles Times, began to import into their composing rooms cutting-edge computerized typesetting equipment. This created enormous anxiety in the International Typographical Union, the ITU. It had 120,000 members and 600 locals. It was incredibly clean, it was incredibly democratic, and it was incredibly militant.
The head of the union at the time, Bertram Powers, believed that he had enough economic leverage to prevent the onward march of technology. What could have possibly made him think that he could impose the status quo on these powerful publishers?
In our own time, labor unions are weak, but the story I've written took place in the early 1960s, and many of the members of the union were hardcore militant labor men. 120,000 ITU members around the country voted to give 3% of their weekly paychecks to a strike fund, and that enabled Bert Powers and the ITU to have all the money they needed for the 62-63 strike.
With hindsight, though, we can see that Powers was maybe the ultimate Luddite. He believed that you could stop the march of industrial progress.
At the center of the strike was really fear of technology and fear of computers. The International Typographical Union got a pay raise at the end of the strike, but they granted the publishers the right to bring computerized typesetting into the newspaper composing rooms. They won the strike, but they lost the war.
Now, this was 1962. Obviously, no internet, no cable news. Three or four TV stations, radio stations, almost all in a music format. What happens to a city like New York when it loses all seven of its newspapers in one fell swoop and loses them for 4 months?
Nora Ephron, who got her start during the strike, as did Jimmy Breslin and Gay Talese, told me that it was like the city's lifeblood was cut off. Attendance at funerals declined. People did not know when their friends died.
Broadway went dark. Charities lost donations.
There were civil rights implications because the Congress on Racial Equality Corps was leading a boycott against the Seal Test Milk Company. And without the newspapers to publicize this, the boycott was undermined. The city's fight against slumlords was undermined. The building commissioner commented at the time, quote, "There's a distinct difference between a $500 fine and a $500 fine plus a story in the Times."
Of course, 114 days without advertising revenue did harm to all of the properties, and some of them irreparable harm. Tell me what the strike did to the newspapers that were on the edge to begin with.
The only newspaper that was economically strong in the early 60s in New York was the mighty New York Times. Its principal competitor, the New York Herald Tribune, was greatly weakened by the strike. After the strike was settled, the Times and the Herald Tribune each had to raise their cover price from a nickel to a dime And because of the settlement of the strike, which led to higher wages for the printers, the Herald Tribune came back to the streets with a much more precarious balance sheet. And so the strike contributed to the death of the Herald Tribune in 1967. And a few months after the strike, the Mirror, which was a morning competitor to the Daily News, that folded.
But there were some silver linings to this cloud. You made reference to the literary figures whose careers really took off when they had no daily newspaper job to go to.
Correct. Reporters faced a choice. They could march on a picket line and get strike pay, or they could start freelancing. And in the case of Nora Ephron, Pete Hamill, Tom Wolfe, and Gay Talese, they used the opportunity to begin careers as freelance journalists. Talese and Wolfe claim that the strike was central to their careers because it got them writing long-form pieces for magazines. The other thing that happened is with the New York Times not available, people who looked for book reviews had no New York Times Sunday book review. So a small group of intellectuals on the Upper West Side, led by Robert Silvers and Robert Lowe and others, took the opportunity to create a biweekly literary periodical, the New York Review of Books.
And television news, which in 1962 was scarcely developed as a medium, also benefited. Can you tell me how it filled the vacuum left by the newspaper strike?
Most of the local television stations added significant amounts of money to their news budget, and they hired large numbers of reporters. And after the strike ended in the spring of 63, many people who read newspapers never went back to newspapers. They stayed with local TV news.
Well, if cold type was the sword of Damocles to the typographers in 1962, the internet is the same for traditional newspaper employees in 2012. Is there any force out there now that's the equivalent of local number six of the ITU?
For better or worse, we don't have a Burt Powers on the scene. Newspaper employees are more or less defenseless. And it may turn out that the digital newspaper world that's coming, a largely union-free landscape, could turn out to be more exhilarating than the 1960s. But I'm nostalgic about the fact that the thud of the newspaper on our front steps in the morning won't be there.
Scott, thank you.
Bob, thank you.
Scott Sherman is a contributing writer for The Nation, and he wrote The Long Goodbye for VanityFair.com.
Newspapers were not just the chroniclers of our nation. They were also, to a great degree, its foundation. We discover that and much more in Paul Starr's masterful history, The Creation of the Media. It begins when America is merely a series of colonies along the eastern seaboard and ends with the nation's entry into World War II in December of 1941. Much has changed since 1941 that this book does not directly address, and yet it has managed to overturn, or at least modify, every assumption I've made over the years about how the American media arrived in this form at this point in history. When we spoke to Starr back in August of 2005, he explained how the American Revolution united the patriots and the printers.
We were the first country in the world to embody the principle of freedom of the press in our organic law, in our Constitution. It wasn't just that we guaranteed the press the freedom from government intervention. The government actually took positive steps to promote a free press by subsidizing newspapers, by creating a system of free exchange among newspapers. And you have to see this in contrast to what existed in Europe at the time, where in Britain and France and other countries, there wasn't only censorship, there were very heavy taxes levied upon the press. And so instead of taxing the press, we subsidized the press. We had more newspapers. By the time Alexis de Tocqueville came to America, he said Americans go into the wilderness with their axes, their Bibles, and their newspapers.
And your book's underlying message is that it was never mainly about the technology, and it wasn't even mainly about the marketplace, although they both played huge roles. It was mainly about politics.
Yes, I think the early considerations that dominated policy were, first of all, the fear of the disintegration of the republic. How could we hold this country together? And so there were what you might call today nation-building purposes. But it wasn't just any kind of nation that the founders were concerned to build. They were concerned to build a republic. This was a system that subsidized the distribution of political news.
And it's very interesting because, as you say, it was a fragile nation, one spread out over a vast territory, and yet the politicians were willing to put up with a great deal more rancor and vilification in the newspapers they essentially subsidized than is acceptable today.
Well, they weren't entirely happy about this. Washington was attacked, John Adams, and of course, in the late 1790s, under President Adams, Congress passed a measure to try to control criticism, the Sedition Act. But the failure of the Sedition Act really set a very important precedent that, in practice, American politics wasn't going to accept that kind of control.
How did you figure out that the interview was invented by American journalists in 1860?
Well, when important people wanted to have their words in the press before the 1860s, those words appeared in the form of a speech or in the form of an essay. They didn't allow themselves to be put on the spot, ask questions that were, going to make them blurt out something they didn't want to say. And this was not done in European newspapers. So it was only in the mid-1800s that this practice began in America, and it has a certain egalitarian aspect to it. It puts the reporter more on the level of the person that's being interviewed.
Now, in your book, over and over again, you demonstrate that contrary to what I think is the popular opinion today, it wasn't the technology that pushed forward how we have our national conversation, that the ground was already tilled for that kind of communication before the technology came along.
Well, what I suggest in this book is that when new technologies come along, they provoke a political question. How is this new medium going to be handled? Is it going to be private? Is it going to be public? Is it going to be a military technology? What will be the basic purposes that it serves? And so Europe and America often dealt with the same technology in very different ways. When the electric telegraph first appeared, the Europeans treated it as a military technology. We treated it as a commercial technology. The telephone, same thing. There was a period in the 1890s, early 1900s, when there were hundreds of little mutual telephone companies, independent telephone cooperatives that were established, and telephones spread much more widely, much faster in America than elsewhere.
Why don't you give the example of how the telephone developed here as opposed to the Soviet Union?
After the Soviet Revolution, there was a choice about what kind of investment to make in communications technology, and the Soviets could have invested more in telephones. They didn't. They chose another new technology, the loudspeaker.
So everybody knew what everyone was saying and everyone heard the same thing.
Well, yes, it's a means of projecting the authority of the state.
How about distinguishing between the development of, say, the telephone and the telegraph on our shores?
The telegraph actually illustrates the American dilemma, the problems that we've run into through our history in communications. Because initially, we had a highly competitive telegraph industry with dozens of different firms. But it took only about 20 years for the industry to fall under the control of the Western Union Company, which was actually the first national monopoly of any kind in the United States. And we were totally unprepared for it. We had no antitrust law. We had no principle to deal with this new phenomenon of concentrated private power. And the monopoly of Western Union was especially dangerous because Western Union had a partnership with the Associated Press, which was controlled by a small number of newspapers.
And was America's first monopoly news service.
Right. And so together, they monopolized the distribution of national news. And they were in a position, really, to alter the understanding that Americans had of what was happening politically. And I think in the case of the 1876 election, I try to show that that monopoly helped throw the election in one direction rather than another.
So the development of the telegraph could be seen as an early object lesson in the perils of media consolidation.
Absolutely. In the late 19th, early 20th century, we saw the emergence of antitrust law, and that did help to limit the amount of concentrated control. And then when radio developed, at first there was a great profusion of different radio stations around the country. But relatively quickly, again, by the late 1920s, NBC and CBS had come to dominate radio. And then during the late 1930s, the New Deal began to question whether this concentrated power was such a good thing. And that resulted in the breakup of NBC, so resulted in the spinning off of ABC, and to limits on the ownership of radio stations. And of course, that brings us down to issues that are still very contemporary with us.
So, having traced the complicated path of American media up to 1941, how would you rate the balance of power between business and government and the individual today? Has it fallen out of equilibrium?
Well, I think the worries that Western Union provoked in the 19th century, the worries that the early radio networks provoked during the 1930s, are worth recalling, partly because we face those same issues today. And one of the things that I think is so valuable about the American tradition, here going back to the founding of our country, was a preference for a more decentralized system of communication that provided a tremendous amount of opportunity for new voices to be heard.
And what happened at various points in American history when various technologies got locked up by monopolies?
Well, one of the things I think that's good about the American pattern is that we generally haven't let the company or companies that dominate a prior technology from also controlling a new technology. So if you think about it, the post office didn't get control of the telegraph as happened in Europe. And then Western Union didn't get control of the telephone. And then Bell Telephone didn't get control of broadcasting. So we had competition across the different means of communication. Now today, one of the things, again, that's worrying is that, of course, the media conglomerates span different media. We don't have that degree of separation, which I think was a very healthy influence in the past.
Paul Starr, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Paul Starr is the author of The Creation of the Media, Political Origins of Modern Communications.
Coming up, television where everything old is new again, and then really new, and really, really dark.
You brought those guys out there. This is your responsibility.
Like I came to you begging to cook men. Oh, hey, nerdiest old dude I know. You want to come cook Crystal? Please. I'd ask my diaper-wearing granny, but her wheelchair wouldn't fit in the RV.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, working to protect individuals and businesses by ensuring accurate internet search results and authentic online reviews. More at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION. Support for On the Media also comes from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, at GatesFoundation.org. The William and Flora Hewitt Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world. On the web at Hewlett.org. On the Media is supported by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform designed to provide a simple way to create a website or online portfolio. Squarespace provides templates and drag-and-drop tools so users can create their own professional websites. Every website includes a mobile design that automatically scales to any device, hosting, and e-commerce. And for users who would like extra help, Squarespace provides 24/7 support. For a free trial, visit squarespace.com/media.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. After hearing Paul Starr, we're reminded how much of our media history is forgotten, even relatively recent history. As everyone knows, the first big broadcast networks were NBC, CBS, and ABC, joined almost 30 years ago, my how time flies, by upstart Fox. But what you may not remember, or possibly even ever knew, is that there was a fourth network at the dawn of television. In the 40s and early 50s, that network aired some of the most popular programs of its day and set the template for some of the most watched shows of today. It was the Dumont Network, and its rise and fall are chronicled in the book, The Forgotten Network, Dumont and the Birth of American Television. David Weinstein is the author, and I spoke to him back in 2004.
Alain Dumont was a scientist and he was an engineer. He was a shy man, was most comfortable tinkering around with different equipment in his laboratory. But because of his skills as an engineer, he decided to get into television, and he found himself in the thick of the industry.
On the one hand, in your book, you describe Dumont as a sort of techno geek, fiddling with the controls behind his TV to improve the picture, but not paying any attention to the actual program. On the other hand, he built a TV network, so he clearly wasn't entirely clueless.
A lot of the people who worked at Dumont were young, creative, and there was not a lot of middle management. And they created many of the programs that defined early television, shows like Captain Video, The Cavalcade of Stars with Jackie Gleason.
Let's talk about Captain Video for a moment. This, I would say, is just before the so-called golden age of television began. It was still quite experimental.
Fighting for law and order, Captain Video operates from a mountain retreat with secret agents at all points of the globe. Possessing scientific secrets and scientific weapons, Captain Video asks no quarter and gives none to the forces of evil. Stand by for Captain Video!
So, David, Star Wars, it wasn't.
No, it wasn't. It was the kind of show the critics didn't totally understand, but the kids loved. They had things like the atomic rifle, which was basically a toy gun with a muffler on top.
When you say a muffler, you're talking about an automobile muffler, no?
Literally an automobile muffler taped onto a toy rifle.
Among its other pioneering efforts, you write that Dumont essentially invented daytime television. How did that come to pass?
Yes, at the time, no other broadcaster was broadcasting during the day except for an occasional ball game. One of the reasons for that is that the other TV networks also own radio networks, and they wanted to protect their radio interests by not having television compete with radio. Dumont, on the other hand, wanted to sell TV sets, and it wanted to stimulate television. They had shopping programs similar to the Home Shopping Network. They had television kindergarten, telling moms to put their kids in front of the TV while they taught coloring. The moms could do the dishes, and then they would make a loud noise at the end of the program so the mom would know to come back and watch the child. They were very conscious of trying to create programs that would fit the rhythms of the housewife that was the ideal daytime viewer.
Now, you would think that as perspicacious as they were in understanding their audience, that they might have had some advantages vis-a-vis the other networks. But you write that from the very beginning, the Dumont network really struggled.
Yes. Unfortunately for Dumont, in 1952, the FCC released its major allocation decision, and it only allocated four or more stations in seven markets. What this meant for Dumont is that it would really only have access to seven markets, and that was not enough for the network to be viable. So by 1955, the Dumont network had ceased operations, and Alain Dumont was no longer in charge of the company. Dumont Broadcasting was changed to Metropolitan Broadcasting. Later it became Metro Media.
And would be purchased by whom in order to start what?
To Rupert Murdoch, and that became the foundation for the Fox network.
What legacy of Alain Dumont's essential vision do you think is most lasting?
We talked a little bit about daytime television, talk shows for women, crime dramas. One of my favorites was a program called The Plainclothesman that was shown totally from the point of view of a detective. You never saw him on screen, but you saw everything through him.
Hero without uniform. Unknown, unsung, but always on guard, protecting you against crime.
And in some ways, even a show like Cops, which tries to take you on a ride with the police officer, is similar to The Plainclothesman. And if you go through a number of genres, variety shows, comedy, Dumont aired a program called Cavalcade of Stars, for example, which starred Jackie Gleason. Jackie Gleason developed the Honeymooners on that program. I don't know if we would have the Honeymooners without Dumont.
David, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Bob.
David Weinstein is author of The Forgotten Network, Dumont and the Birth of American Television.
What am I, oh my, oh, the only one I've met who ever thrilled me so?
AMC's Breaking Bad returns this weekend for its final 8-episode run. It's about the cancer-ridden chemistry teacher turned meth kingpin, Walter White, and his downward spiral from milquetoast to monster. Unless, of course, he always was a monster. Anyway, the critics love it. I love it. You can find an answer to why creator Vince Gilligan's Breaking Bad has joined the pantheon of great series, including The Sopranos, The Wire, Mad Men, and more in TV's current golden age, in Brett Martin's new book, Difficult Men: Behind the Scenes of a Creative Revolution. With that title, he refers both to the main characters in those episodic dramas and the men who gave birth to them.
And they were making television about men, about masculinity, and about men in combat. The heroes that they brought us, the quote-unquote heroes, were engaged in a constant kind of battle between their most primal male urges and civilization, so to speak.
Why don't we play that most often played clip from Breaking Bad?
I am not in danger, Skyler. I am the danger. A guy opens his door and gets shot, and you think that of me? No. I am the one who knocks.
Is that what all these characters, not just Breaking Bad's Walter White, but Mad Men's Don Draper and Tony Soprano, is that what they're all striving for, to be the one who knocks?
In some way, yeah. And I think that's the button they push in viewers, for sure. We're both attracted to the idea of assuming that kind of male power, and we're repelled by it. It's an extraordinarily powerful, seductive thing to watch.
And we started watching it with The Sopranos. As you note, it couldn't have been made without any number of groundbreaking predecessors, but this is the one that really changed the landscape of television, I think. HBO gave David Chase, a notorious chronic misanthrope, a chance to make this, and it wasn't an easy show to make.
It was extremely hard. I mean, it was very hard on its star, who was as responsible as anybody else for creating this golden age in James Gandolfini. And what we got as viewers, this incredibly fully realized portrayal that not only was very fearless in portraying Tony's ugliness and his rage and his terribleness, but also gave you a kind of soulful relatability.
But trust me, there's millions of girls out there that are dying to meet a guy like you. I see him every day.
Oh, right. No, I'm so special.
You're damn right you are. You're handsome and smart and a hard worker. And let's be honest, white, that's a huge plus nowadays.
Gandolfini really had to dive into that character, and it was a hard character to live in. I begin my book with a story of him disappearing for about 3 days in the middle of sort of the peak of The Sopranos and eventually finding himself in a Brooklyn beauty parlor without any identification. I tell that story to talk about the size of the production. People who were around it, one person suggested to me that it was like being around the Beatles. It had that kind of white-hot, center-of-the-universe feeling about it.
And Gandolfini was fundamentally a shy guy.
A shy guy who looked like Tony Soprano when he went out on the streets and couldn't really escape that. You know, he made a lot of people's lives at that time rather difficult. And to a man and a woman, when I talked to them, they understood and they really loved him.
Now let's switch to the showrunner, the creator, David Chase. He doesn't understand why he's always being depicted as so grumpy. On the other hand, you do report that he once told a colleague he would never be happy till he killed a man with his bare hands.
Yeah, it's hard to know what to make of David Chase when he says that it's a mystery to him why everybody thinks he's such a misanthrope, because it's really his identity. You know, a very troubled guy, grew up in New Jersey, a devotee of the great film auteurs, believed he was here to make the films that he loved from, you know, the Italian New Wave, then Scorsese and Coppola, and was absolutely filled with self-loathing for having sold out, as he saw it, and gone to television, and continued to feel that way, even having transformed television and arguably made one of the great works of art of the 21st century. I call him the reluctant Moses of the third golden age, which is that he sort of opened the door, led everybody to the promised land, but couldn't quite go in himself.
And he created the show, as the other difficult men, with autocratic creativity, which really did seem to reflect the concerns and obsessions of the creators. In The Sopranos, you can see some of David Chase's vision for the show laid out in the first episode, right? You mentioned when Tony tells his therapist, Dr. Melfi, that he feels he was born too late.
But lately, I'm getting the feeling that I came in at the end. The best is over.
Many Americans, I think, feel that way.
I think about my father. He never reached the heights like me. But in a lot of ways, he had it better. He had his people. They had their standards. They had pride. Today, what do we got?
As David Chase became the boss of this, you know, ever-increasing world, so too did Tony, his stress mount. And in many ways, all of these shows wind up being about making television shows. And the other thing about that clip is that it's the moment when you realize that the ambition here is not just simply to have a show about funny New Jersey mobsters, but really say something about America. And from that moment on, you could watch for both things. You could watch for the kind of frisson and the blood and all the things that a great mob genre story give you, but also because it was really a great story about, you know, the emptiness of the American dream. And that's the kind of connection to the audience that marked that show and all these other really bad guys we wound up rooting for.
Let's switch for a second to Mad Men, which comes from Matt Weiner's head, a former Sopranos writer. You said that in some ways these shows are really about making shows?
Certainly that is true of Mad Men, which is, after all, about a group of creative people stuck together in an office, forced to collaborate and make their talents subsidiary to some great visionary like Don Draper. One of the things that began to happen first on The Sopranos and then more pronouncedly on Mad Men is that it had traditionally always been part of a showrunner's portfolio to rewrite their writers. George Pelicanos, who was a great novelist in his own right when he wrote for The Wire, couldn't believe how much David Simon had rewritten his stuff. And Simon said to him, you know, how much do you think was there? And he said, probably 30%. And he said, you're doing pretty good, which is not something that novelists are used to. But in any event, it's a given that you're going to be rewritten a lot. And since sort of time immemorial, you would nevertheless get sole credit on a script. And David Chase began to get very fed up with this and began putting his own name on scripts as a co-writer. And Matt Weiner, as he did with many things that he learned in the Sopranos writer's room, took that to yet another level. And I believe it's something like 90% of the Mad Men scripts share credit with whoever the original writer was and Matt Weiner. That's a long way of saying that that tension showed up on Mad Men itself as Peggy, the young copywriter, complains about not getting sufficient credit for a commercial that she's written.
You gave me 20 ideas and I picked out one of them that was a kernel that became that commercial.
So you remember?
I do. It was something about a cowboy. Congratulations.
No, it was something about a kid locked in a closet because his mother was making him wait for the floor to dry, which is basically the whole commercial.
It's a kernel.
Which you changed just enough so that it was yours.
I changed it into a commercial. What, are we going to shoot him in the dark in the closet? That's the way it works. There are no credits on commercials.
But you got the Clio.
It's your job. I give you money, you give me ideas.
And you never say thank you.
That's what the money is for.
So in this instance, you think maybe Weiner's owning up a little bit to that tension?
I think so. I think that in many ways, unlike a movie which, say, will shoot for a year, 2 years or something like that and then be over, these shows are meant to last for a very long time. And it means that as they develop, so too do the people writing them.
Let me ask you about a scene from The Wire. A witness tells a cop that a character named Snot Boogie, who was murdered, always stole the money from their weekly dice game. Finally, someone shot him.
I gotta ask you, if every time Snot Boogie would grab the money and run away, why'd you even let him in the game?
What?
If Snot Boogie always stole the money, why'd you let him play?
Got to. This America, man.
I mean, the ambition of The Wire, you know, was nothing less than really portraying an entire American city.
And this was David Simon's vision of America.
That's right. David Simon, who had been a great journalist, who saw suddenly this opportunity to do something in television that one would never have imagined could be done before.
And was he a difficult man?
Some might say that, yes. David Simon is no shortage of ego, and in particular believes in the power of argument as a creative force, and so surrounded himself with brilliant minds and sort of created a kind of combative atmosphere in a writer's room from which The Wire sprang.
But he would bring in people specifically to argue with.
Right. You know, he had been raised in a very loud, argumentative, the way he described it to me was one of his brothers brought over a girlfriend who thought, boy, this family hates each other. And that was just a normal Friday night dinner. And he had the gift of the confidence to have opposing viewpoints in the writer's room.
Surprisingly, though, you say that Breaking Bad is in many ways the culmination of everything that the Golden Age made possible, and yet it was created in what you call the happiest room in Hollywood by the least difficult of these difficult men. You could draw a tremendous contrast between David Chase, who launched The Sopranos, and Vince Gilligan, who launched Breaking Bad. I mean, aside from the fact that he's just one guy who isn't named David.
Right. No, you couldn't have two more different people in that way. Vince Gilligan insists on collaboration as the most important aspect in what's made Breaking Bad what it is. Now, David Chase was notorious for dismissing writers that had been large parts, arguably, of creating The Sopranos. Probably that stemmed to some extent from the frustration of having to have collaboration at all, of not doing what his film heroes could do and be the sole author.
Could we talk about legacy? I mean, you observe that the creator of HBO's Girls, Lena Dunham, was only 13 when The Sopranos came out, and the notion of TV as a wasteland probably seemed like a rumor from another universe.
In fact, if anything, you know, a writer starting out now would probably be pointed more towards television if he or she wanted to do good work than in film.
Would you want to work for these guys?
Well, even the nicest one of them, I don't want to work for. writing in a writer's room is an incredible task of finding a way to express yourself while being almost completely subsidiary to another man or another woman's vision. So that doesn't suit me terribly well. But do I envy the ability to create an entire universe and see it through to the end? Of course, any writer would.
Brett, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Brett Martin is the author of Difficult Men, Behind the Scenes of a Creative Revolution, from The Sopranos and The Wire to Mad Men and Breaking Bad. Crystal blue persuasion.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sara Druckmann, and Chris Neary. We had more help from Molly Buckley and Olivia Wheats, and the show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Andrew Dunn.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm the one who knocks.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.
Thanks for listening to this week's On the Media podcast, a free service of WNYC Radio. Find out where On the Media is playing in your area and support your local public radio station by going to onthemedia.org. You can support this podcast by making a donation at wnyc.org.